Welcome to the Album Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Andy, Don, and Dude.
Hello, lovers. It is I, Dude. This is the Album Nerds Podcast. Got Andy and Don with me. Andy, are you ready to talk about your love?
Are you inviting me into the hot tub, man? Oh, my God. Yeah, I'm a little worried about this episode, man. We got album picks from our lovers. I'm a little concerned we're going to offend some people in the process here.
Yes, but passion comes from anger, and anger turns to love.
You feeling the love over there, Don?
Are you alone? Because you've got my interest.
Oh, God.
Alone? Oh, my gosh. Was that on like a little candy heart or something?
Are you French? Because I fell for you.
Oh, this is ChatGPT all day long.
Do you like raisins? How do you feel about a date?
Oh, God.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay. So this is the Album Nerds Podcast. We love albums, the album format, and terrible jokes. Today, we've got a great show for you. We're going to be talking about a lover's collection. So albums that our special someones love. Then Don's going to ask us a deep question. And we're going to have some shout outs to some other albums or album related items that we're digging. And then we're going to spin that wheel of musical discovery to find out what we'll be talking about next time. But this week, it's all about our lovers.
Who else wants to talk about the lover?
That's what I'm talking about!
So, a romantic relationship is not just a union of souls, it can also be a combining of music collections. Exploring a spouse's album collection can be an enlightening journey through their tastes and experiences. You can find both treasures and trash. And today, each of us will present an album from our romantic partner's collections.
Trash, jeez.
We all have trash in our collections.
Speak for yourself, man.
Yeah, so it's always an interesting conversation with your partner, wife, husband, lover, whatever, about your music collection, what you used to love, what you do love now, and finding that common ground. And so this is an interesting journey, just saying, hey, you know, what's an album that really sticks out to you as important or great or that you enjoyed when you were young. So this was fun to try and look at it from that perspective. And so I'm sure these conversations led to several potential album picks. What other albums did you think about for this show before making your final choice?
Yeah. We talked long into the night about potential records to go over.
Strawberries and whipped cream. Champagne.
Of course. Every conversation we have includes those things. You mentioned a couple that I was not super familiar with. The other one that I didn't pick was Sublime's 40 Ounce of Freedom.
Thank God.
Yeah, I know that you had some reservations about that record, dude. It was the debut album for that ska punk group. Very popular. Or being on the radio, quite a few singles from that record. Mm-hmm. Apparently one of the most successful independent releases of the era. Didn't know that. Yeah, that's a cool sound. I mean, that's a good gateway to reggae, I think, that album and that band, perhaps. How about you, Don?
Well, you know, probably my wife's favorite artist is Keith Urban, but we did one of his albums not too long ago. Another one I considered was Blake Shelton, his album from 2016, If I'm Honest, actually came out not long after his divorce from Miranda Lambert. And so that's actually there in the record. You know, there's some breakup songs on there that are kind of fun.
Sounds juicy.
That guy has so many hits. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. He's just, you know, he just has a charming way about him.
Yeah.
You know,
an everyman vibe, even though he's like not at this point.
Right. Yeah. How about you, dude?
Toto 4 is an album my wife had when she was a kid. And I guess she got it as a birthday or Christmas present at one point. And it was released in April of 82. It was their fourth studio album, thus Toto 4. It features this like that polished blend of rock, pop, and jazz, and had Africa on it, which was famously recently covered by Weezer.
Right.
Rosanna, which is another really well-known track. And Toto also was involved in a lot of other projects, including Michael Jackson's Thriller. But it's just so clean and fun to listen to. But I wanted to go with something that maybe went a little deeper lyrically. So no Toto this time, folks. Sorry. All right. Why don't we get into our choices?
You choose me?
All right. For my lover's collection selection.
Ooh.
We're going with the ODB, Old Dirty Bastard.
That's romantic.
Nothing more romantic than ODB. His debut album, Return to the 36 Chambers, the dirty version. Let's hear the second single and the second cut, Shimmy Shimmy Ya. Shimmy Shimmy Ya, Shimmy Ya, Shimmy Ya. Give me the mic so I can take it away. That is, of course, the old Dirty Bastard himself there, with production by RZA. This was the second in the series of solo Wu-Tang albums that came out after their big debut a couple of years prior. This is the follow-up to Method Man's Tikal, which was in 1994. Yeah, I remember this record kind of making a pretty big splash when I was in school. I remember the album art quite prevalently being around my high school. So my wife grew up listening to this record in high school. Wu-Tang was big in her with her friend group, and she can rap the first 8 tracks, I would say, pretty much straight through without hesitation. Yeah, it's dangerous putting this album out at the house because she will just tear into it pretty quickly.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you guys could have one of those nice moments when you're sitting at the piano and you could start going ding, 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 ding. She could shimmy, shimmy ya for
she
you.
She could just chime in. Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. I'm definitely the RZA of the relationship, I would say. My clickbait headline for Return to 36 Chambers is ODB takes the wheel and immediately jumps the curb, runs through a fruit stand, and parks in the middle of a fountain. This is a pretty unhinged record, as you probably would expect if you know anything about ODB. He's a pretty messy, energetic, creative figure. Mm-hmm. And this record, I think, captures his essence pretty well, the good and the bad of those parts of his personality. There's some great moments on here, I think, that do rival the Wu-Tang's debut, especially towards the beginning of the record. But in all my honest opinion, as the record goes on, it kind of falls apart more and more. And there's just so many odd skits and singing, and ODB has this kind of odd singing voice he uses a couple times during the record.
I feel like there had to be 50 people in the room trying to keep him on track. Yeah. Like, hey, yeah, man, right. You got to do this verse now. Like, you got to get something on tape today. You know, that's you can feel it even throughout the album. That's just my feeling.
Yeah. I know the album took over 2 years to produce, I guess, which is, even back then, that's a long time to make a record. All right, let's jump in here and play. This is track 4. I believe this is also a single off the album. This is Brooklyn Zoo.
I'm the one man army ace on. I never been tooken out. I keep MCs looking out. I drop signs like Crosby dropping babies.
So Brooklyn Zoo seems to be kind of a tirade against some unknown adversary. One of the potential origin stories is that it was born out of an argument he had with members of the group Brooklyn Zoo, who I guess he hung out with a lot. According to Brooklyn Zoo member Buddha Monk, ODB channeled the energy and anger from this dispute into the recording booth and used some of the words and phrases from that argument to craft the track.
So something like a musical equivalent of a lover's quarrel.
Yeah. It's like, are we getting Chinese? Are we getting pizza? But, kind of typical of the record, it's, kind of simple backing, just that piano, that little piano melody that they use quite a bit. Actually, he uses the line, shame on you when you step through the old dirty bastard Brooklyn Zoo. He basically says the same thing in Protect Your Neck on the Wu-Tang record. All right, so my clickbait headline is ODB reminds album nerd why he was never into hip-hop.
Oh, boy.
And that's a... That's not really a diss.
Don't say that.
That's not really a diss.
That's not a diss.
But it's just so crass and crude.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably intentionally off-putting, but it's just so, there's that word sophomoric again, and juvenile. It feels like, my friends and I used to record ourselves just saying nonsense, and sounds like something we would have recorded for each other. Uh-huh. But on the other hand, I do think there's some magic here. I think his sort of sing-songy rap style is kind of interesting. I'm not really sure who else does that. Maybe Busta Rhymes kind of has something like that. Maybe Biz Markie. But yeah, it seems to be unique. And I like the way he raps. I think the backing tracks are perfect and sort of eerie feel, which, I don't know, somehow works with his weird nature, just this thing that can't be contained, Well, this is like the anti-intellectual album, compared to other things we've listened to recently.
Yeah, sure. Compared to the Tribe record last week is kind of the opposite.
Yeah, but on the other hand, like, I get the sense that maybe, like, he plays sort of a buffoon, but I bet he's actually, like, a genius.
Oh, that's a different guy. That's the jizz.
Oh, right. Oops. But yeah, I mean, you know, he's a character, you know, and I think he's sort of crafting his character. I don't know. I feel like there's more to him.
Yeah, you wonder how much of this is like a character he's putting on or a persona versus who he actually is. Yeah.
Or was.
Right. Just the, you know, the first time ever you sucked my
Oh, jeez.
Is that the name of the song?
That was in the intro, right?
I think so.
Oh, that 5-minute intro track?
Yeah.
I do feel like, yeah, it is very immature on purpose.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think your point about playing a character to some degree is probably true. I mean, because Wu-Tang Clan was not only a rap collective, they're also a group of friends. And everyone kind of plays their role in a group of friends. And if he was the doing crazy stuff, saying crazy stuff guy, then that personality has to be amplified for the for the performative side of things. And I agree that sometimes I feel like it goes too far. There are moments when I was made to feel uncomfortable, but that's the point. And I think the people who really loved this album, those were the moments that intrigued them the most. You know,
they kind of embrace that it makes other people uncomfortable. And sort of,
yeah.
All right, let's jump in here and play another cut from the record. This is track 3, Baby Come On.
That's what you gotta do, what you got to do. Come on, can I get the Wu-Tang? Wu-Tang, Wu-Tang.
I like that moment in that song, probably among the best besides Shimmy Shimmy Ya, just because it feels the most like a track that would have potentially been on a Wu-Tang album. It feels a little more focused and in control. But yeah, I mean, again, braggadocious lyrics, minimalist, grimy beats, and it really exemplifies this album as a whole, personality-driven hip-hop and rap, as opposed to lyrical meaning, painting pictures of the landscape around them, or whatever. You know, this is about this guy's personality.
Yeah.
It's definitely on display here. Yeah. My clickbait headline to describe Return to the 36 Chambers. Is there a clean version?
There's not a clean version.
Old Dirty Bastard took the Wu-Tang Clan's raw energy and embraces the madness.
Yeah.
I think he just probably even lived that way in that universe, I guess. So unpredictable. I read that the RZA had to piece together verses from random studio recordings to make some of the tracks.
I believe it.
Sort of a no rules approach to rapping, whether it be with what you say or with the way that flows happen, the disruption in a flow, the change of cadence.
It's so wild to hear like ODB rap a verse and then hear like someone like Method Man, who was like pretty on the beat and let, you know, you can understand what he's saying.
Yes.
Go back to back.
That's part of the problem too.
Yeah.
Is losing any kind of threads throughout. That's why the songs that work best are the ones with like a raise your hands in the air moment, like the saying Wu-Tang and or Shimmy Shimmy Ya, and like something that you can grab onto, even if it's nonsense.
Yeah, bring it all back together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is not for everyone, I don't think, even hip-hop heads. It's inconsistency and its length. An album this long being unfocused makes it a challenge at times. I do feel that his unique style and personality worked better in the group setting.
Yeah,
I agree.
Because then it's a flavor in the overall recipe. You know, it's...
Yeah, you need some meat and potatoes in there too. You can't just have all flavor.
Yeah, just drinking a bottle of hot sauce is what it's like listening to this record. You know?
Yeah, seriously.
But I do think this album is a classic in that it captures his unique talent, and he is a hip-hop pioneer, warts and all, and this is at the peak of his creativity, even though it needed a little help from his friends. But this character that exists now in hip-hop history exists because this album so effectively showcased it, even though sometimes it's hard to keep your eye on the ball.
Yeah, I think he has a little bit of a mythology around him now. He's kind of a larger-than-life character, especially after his passing away, about 10 years after this album. All right, well, that is my wife's selection there. Go ODB, Return to 36 Chambers, the dirty version. Definitely an interesting little capsule from that mid-90s hip-hop. If you're not familiar with what was going on with Wu-Tang, it's a great place to jump in.
Before we continue on our lover's journey, why don't we hear from our friend Jess from Music Notes with Jess.
Hi, I'm Jessica Ann Katina. I've always loved music and surround myself with it every day. I've sung in choirs, took digital musical classes in college, and used to work in radio. To further share my knowledge and experience with others, I created this podcast, Music Notes with Jess, in 2019. I'm so fortunate of the listener growth and hearing back from some of the celebs I discussed in past episodes. That's why now I'm ready to expand. So let's have fun taking weekly music notes of throwbacks, modern hits, and media. Thank you. Talk to you soon on Music Notes with Jess.
Go check out Music Notes with Jess wherever you get your podcasts after you listen to ours.
So my pick from my lover's collection comes from Night Rangers, Midnight Madness from 1983. This is the second album by the rock band formed in San Francisco in 1979. The band's lineup at the time was bassist and vocalist Jack Blades, guitarist Brad Gillis, drummer vocalist Kelly Keegi, guitarist Jeff Watson, and keyboardist Alan Fitzgerald. Was in the band Montrose with Sammy Hagar. Ah,
Sammy Hagar, nice.
Yeah. So, you know, my wife, she and her friends, like in college, I guess, you know, really latched on to Night Ranger, and, you know, they were really big fans, and I've actually seen them live a bunch of times with them.
Well, Jack Blade's a good looking dude, too.
Oh, yeah. Yep. I'm sure that was part of it.
Of course.
All right. Well, let's hear the biggest hit from this album. It's Sister Christian.
Sister Christian, oh, the time has come.
All right, so Sister Christian was written and sung by drummer Kelly Keegi. It was inspired by his younger sister, Christy. After visiting his hometown of Eugene, Oregon, he was struck by how quickly she was growing up. She was 10 years younger than him. He wrote the song, expressing his feelings as a protective older brother. Apparently, when he introduced this song to his bandmates, he was actually saying Sister Christy, but they mistook it as Sister Christian, and so they stuck with that. Hmm. And it's got the term motoring in it. You know, it's motoring.
Like, I always wondered, so does that mean moving through life quickly, motoring?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was kind of a reference to sort of cruising around, you know, like young people do. But I think, yeah, motoring is probably also a moving through life, as you say.
Now young people cruise around, but mostly in Fortnite. Yeah, instead of in actual cars.
Yeah, true.
Scroll cards. Around more than anything.
All right, well, my clickbait headline for Midnight Madness is Night Ranger goes motoring down Sentimental Street with melodic hooks. Sentimental Street was actually a hit that came on their next album, Seven Witches. But yeah, I mean, it's a lot of just sentimental lyrics, you know, lots of love and love lost kind of stuff. I mean, it's arena rock, I think, more than it is like glam rock. Like, I think it has more in common with like the Journeys of the World. And
those things hadn't been completely defined yet, though.
Right.
I think bands were struggling when they were like hard rock bands. Like, I preferred their first album, Dawn Patrol. It was a little edgier. This one, the edges are smoothed off a little bit. But, you know, the name of the game was getting on MTV and getting on the radio. Mm-hmm. And at that time, making devil horns and stuff wasn't going to get you a number one hit.
Did Sister Christian have a good video?
Oh, yeah.
Very cinematic.
Yeah. And the same girl that is in that is also in the When You Close Your Eyes video.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would say they, you know, I mean, they have more in common probably with like Billy Joel than Judas Priest, I think. You know, I mean, these are just pop songs. Although, I mean, they're a bit more aggressive than Journey and Foreigner, I think, because they got like the dual guitars. And I mean, I think both guitarists in the group, Brad Gillis, who had played with Ozzy after Randy Rhoads passed away, and Jeff Watson, I think they're both technically, you know, very good guitarists. They seem to have some cred among musicians of that time, of that rock world, you know, but others have called them the Air Supply of heavy metal.
Yeah, I read that too.
Anyway, well, let's hear more. Here's When You Close Your Eyes.
Yeah, so this is a power ballad about lost love and nostalgia. They were kind of kings of the early power ballad. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they were the first to do it, but they definitely were good at it. These are well-crafted well-written songs. Lyrically, they're interesting, I think, especially for the time. But it's about the lingering feelings and memories of past relationship and then wondering if your former lover is still thinking about you, you know?
Yeah. According to the video, the former lover is married to a chimp.
Oh, well, interesting. Check that out.
Lost my lover to a monkey.
Heart wants what the heart wants, right? Yeah, so there are soaring vocals on here. Def Leppard-esque, like that part we played, you know, kind of feels a little bit like the early Def Leppard stuff. It just doesn't take it up to 11. It keeps it down around 7. And that's fine. I think it works for this song. My clickbait headline to describe the album, not quite metal, not quite pop. Midnight Madness proves Night Ranger was the ultimate 80s rock tweener. As, you know, we kind of got to, they're not quite Toto, Journey, Styx, REO, Speedwagon, and they're also not quite Def Leppard, Quiet Riot, Judas Priest. They're somewhere in the middle, and I think that's a hard place to be moving forward. At the time, it was the right place to be, like trying to hit all those angles and the fans of all of those types of bands. Overall, I enjoyed it. I thought the vocalists sounded great. I think the songwriting was above average. Sister Christian is like clearly a classic. Yeah, it was just an awkward time in rock music and hard rock music and metal. The labeling had started to begin of what subgenre you were a part of. And
yeah, these guys got kind of left behind once like the Bon Jovis and the Poisons and, you know, all those groups hit, who have a lot in common with Night Ranger, I think.
They do. They're very similar. Mm-hmm. I think maybe the keyboard work may have sanded the edges off a little bit too much. Mm-hmm. Things are electrified and then it just gets really saturated with a little more sappiness. And the keyboard touches were what was doing that for me, especially upon a headphone listen. Like I'd be kind of rocking along like to the Touch of Madness. There's an album highlight for me.
Yeah.
That Nursery Rhyme intro is cool. It's even more Def Leppard-y. And those keys came in and kind of took away from the power of it for me. But yeah, still, I really enjoyed that track as well.
Yeah, I think it suffers from sort of that early and mid-80s production. And a lot of the, like, sort of the hard rock and metal of that time, I think, suffers because it's just very trebly, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think this has been remastered, or at least like the versions I've found are not remastered, and it definitely sounds of its time from a production standpoint. All right, let's hear another one. This is actually the opening cut. You Can Still Rock in America.
You know, thanks to this great country of ours, you still can rock in America.
Yeah, most people can. Yeah, that was the first single from the album that peaked at number 51 on the Billboard. Features Glenn Hughes on backing vocals.
He's
in nice. Deep Purple and Black Sabbath. The Black Sabbath connection there, interesting. Yeah, Blades, who's the lead singer, one of the lead singers.
Yep.
Blades said that he wrote the song as a commentary on what he was seeing when he was out there, when everybody was saying rock was dead.
They're still saying it.
Yeah, I know. Everyone's been saying that since like the 60s, I think.
Yep.
My clickbait headline for Midnight Madness is, Night Ranger concocted the perfect midnight snack, filled with plenty of cheesy lyrics, a heavy dose of repetitive guitar, and a glaze of squeaky production.
Wow.
Yeah, I definitely agree with Don's comment on the production there being very treble focused and squeaky clean, which is not uncommon of the era by any means. I just have real issue with this being labeled as like hard rock or heavy metal and having a keyboard doing the primary rhythm for the group. It just sounds unlike any sort of rock I'm familiar with, I guess. It just feels very pop orientated, I guess, to me. I thought it was a bad thing, but I think positioning it as rock for me feels like you're trying to package this up as something it's not.
Yeah. Well, I think terminology changes. I mean, in the 50s, rock was Chuck Berry. And I think it's a slippery term of, you know, what hard rock is. In 1982 or 3, this was more aggressive guitar-wise than, say, Huey Lewis and the News or something, you know, or Billy Joel, or even REO Speedwagon and Journey and some of those others we mentioned. This one, I feel like it borrows some sounds from the new wave of British heavy metal, dual guitar harmonies and things like that. So
guitar riffs, perhaps, yeah. It just feels very watered down. Like even the guitar riffs are interesting at times. They're very, very repetitive. I think after a few moments, you kind of get the gist of what they're going for here.
Wow. I feel like this was sort of a transitional sort of sound, going mainstream, essentially, of some of those sounds.
Yeah, it does sound like a very mainstream version of that sound, mm-hmm. I guess, which is fine. Just not for me, but that's okay.
It's interesting, Andy, that like you tend to reject like pop from this era, you know, for being like kind of commercial or too mainstream, but then like you embrace, you know, the K-pop or more like dance oriented pop. Like you seem to forgive like, you know, the commercial nature and the poppiness of those genres, but not like 80s rock.
Yeah, what up with that?
Grab a napkin, homie. You just got served.
that's a fair point. I think, I don't know, 80s pop to me always feels like it's kind of pretending to be harder than it is. And whereas today's pop, I don't get that pretension from it at all. It feels like more of a sugary package that's intended for that use. Whereas, and I don't know, 80s pop, like maybe it's just the hair is being longer. It makes me feel like it's trying to be metal or something, you know. And it just doesn't have that low end. It's just not there in the 80s at all. And that really bothers me. It's not a low end era, unfortunately.
All right. Well, for 9 catchy pop hits with a hard rock treatment, check out Night Ranger's Midnight Madness from 1983.
Excuse me, I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Okay, it's time again for Deep Questions by Don. All right, so we've been introduced to some different music by our partners. What other things has your partner introduced you to?
Well, my in-laws.
Hello.
There's a lot of things. Just looking back over, you know, I've been together for like 10 or 12 years now. 11 years.
You better know.
The first couple ones that came to mind would be like gardening. We do a lot of, you know, different houseplants and vegetables and whatnot. And my wife is very knowledgeable about that. My wife was a body massage therapist for many years, so she's taught me a lot about how the body works and different muscle groups and how they all affect each other. She's big into like Indian philosophies and religion, so I know a lot about that from her. I mean, I probably could go on for quite a while, but those are the main things I could think of. How about you, dude?
Well, the one thing that my wife introduced me to was vodka martinis. I'd had gin martinis before, but never vodka martinis. But all sorts of things, obviously, but fatherhood and grandfatherhood, you know, where I married her, my stepdaughter was a teenager and she's grown up and has kids now. So experiencing that tail end of adolescence and crappy boyfriends and all that stuff was, you know, that was eye-opening and grew me up quite a bit pretty quickly. Just kind of becoming a man is what my...
She made you a man.
My wife introduced me to, you know?
So, yeah, I guess, one thing my wife introduced me to caring about is the royal family and like the British monarchy. My whole life, I just couldn't have given, you know, less of a shit about any of that. Like, I remember like when Princess died and I was like, why do people care? You know, but now, you know, I've just... seen so many movies and documentaries, you know, like not just like the current royal family, but going back to Henry VIII and stuff. And it really is kind of fascinating, you know, just that long legacy, of rulers and bad behavior. And, you know, it's just, just like, I guess any kind of history. I mean, the history of the British monarchy is pretty fascinating stuff.
Oh, geez. So you've become like a sleeper agent for the Redcoats, huh? Damn.
I'm a monarchist.
It's a spy.
All right. Well, what did your partner introduce you to? Let us know on Instagram and Facebook or leave a comment on our website, albumnerds.com.
From my lover's collection, I bring Sir Elton John, born Reginald Kenneth Dwight, the renowned British singer, songwriter, pianist, who has achieved much success throughout music and Broadway and blah, blah, blah. It's a long list.
I've heard of him.
His career includes chart-topping albums, singles, contributions to musical films and theater, and probably Lion King being so important to so many people was because of Elton John. But this album is Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy from May of 1975. This is a concept that chronicles the autobiographical story of Elton John and his writing partner, Bernie Taupin. Elton is Captain Fantastic. Bernie is the Brown Dirt Cowboy. And there's themes of hardship, rejection, self-doubt, perseverance, all about their early years up until this point in 1975. Why don't we jump into the opening track, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy.
Brown Dirt Cowboy, still green and growing, city's the captain.
So the track kind of opens as like an Americana, almost country western sort of vibe to it. And then there's that subtle interplay between the electric piano and the acoustic guitar. And it's really about their alter egos of these two starry-eyed young dreamers that met and contributed to each other's musical journey. And then the song really changes throughout. You know, you get a more of a funky rock and roll treatment later on in the song. And, you know, Bernie Taupin would write the lyrics. Elton John would compose around them. And these lyrics are quite detailed and not pop songs per se. And Elton's ability to write music and then find ways to phrase those words is very at the forefront for me of why this is a special album. And my wife grew up loving the album, listening from start to finish over and over again. I'd heard it before, but her stories about spending hours reading the liner notes and exploring the album's art and lyrics, and she had a big crush on Bernie Taupin, not Elton John, which I think that tells you something about someone when the poet, the lyric writer is who they're drawn to, much like me. I'm a deep soul.
Attracted to Bernie as well.
So, by clickbait headline to describe Captain Fantastic, proof that sometimes the nerdy kid at the piano and the cowboy poet end up ruling the world. I mean, they were at their high point here, and to look back on it and try to level set is a really interesting choice to make instead of writing another album full of top 40 hits. So, yeah, I think it's something special.
It's pretty interesting, like, to take a moment, like, in the middle of your career to look back like this. Like, what? I wonder what prompted them to take that moment. You know, it's kind of odd.
I don't know
if they've been working together for a long time at this point, right?
Yeah, like a decade.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it was just like a time of change and growth. Music was changing by 1975, so maybe it was just an opportunity to try to put it all in perspective. And these guys were grown-ups by this point and probably had gone through a lot. All right, why don't we continue our journey with Tell Me When the Whistle Blows.
Well, the street kids remember, can't still shoot the fast cue. Has his country kid still got his soul.
Yeah, bluesy track there about Bernie, who I guess grew up in the country, kind of thinking about that life he had there, and I'm wondering if he could ever get back to it, and if he lost his country soul. I like that idea. My clickbait headline for Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy is, Elton and Bernie weave a colorful tapestry from their collective talents and history. This does, you know, very much feel like a two-hander, like so many of Elton's records are. But I guess you really can sense the camaraderie between the guys here and that just that how deep their relationship is and how much they are dependent on each other for their success. Yeah. They're kind of are tied together at the hip.
Like us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much exactly like us. We'd all be useless on our own. I think what really struck me listening to this record, not being super familiar with Elton John's career at all, his voice sounds fantastic on this record. Just very light and free and just like moves effortlessly through these tracks. Along with the arrangements too are super interesting. It doesn't, like Dude said, it's not really a pop record. It's there's more going on than just like a traditional pop song. The structures are not that expected.
Yeah. You know, interestingly, I read that it was noticed by critics that his voice was a little rough because they just come off a tour, but I think it sounds great too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really does.
It's got just the right timbre and energy and emotion.
Yeah. Not a lot of like anthems or hits on here. I mean, there's like a couple that you might recognize, but yeah, there's some cool string accompaniments and it feels more like More like a Dylan record than like a pop Elton John record, I think, in terms of the density and the poetic quality going on here. So, yeah, I really enjoyed this. I thought it was quite good, and I'll probably come back to it in the future.
All right, so why don't we continue with probably the biggest hit and most recognizable song here, Someone Saved My Life Tonight.
I spend a lot of good mornings with Sugar Bear, Sugar Crisp cereal.
Yeah, here comes the cereal. Yeah.
I thought that was a pet name for your wife.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, Someone Saved My Life Tonight is, of course, written. The music is by Elton John and lyrics are by Bernie Taupin. So the song concludes side one of the album, chronicles their early history, you know, finding their way in the music industry. So this refers to a time in 1968 when John was engaged to be married to his girlfriend, Linda Woodrow. So John and Woodrow were sharing a flat with Taupin. John didn't love her and felt trapped by it. So he made a sort of a half-assed attempt at suicide. He tried to asphyxiate himself with a gas oven, but he left the windows open. So, I mean, that's more a cry for a help.
That's half-assed, yeah.
I thought you were going to say he tried to exfoliate himself.
Yeah, so, you know, fortunately, he wasn't successful, and he took refuge in his friends. One of them was Long John Baldry, and so he is supposedly Sugar Bear, who was this British singer and actor.
Porn star. that's a porn name if ever I heard one.
Well, Sugar Bear convinced him to, you know, not get married and to sort of, you know, focus on his musical career.
Good advice.
Yeah.
The lyrics, "And butterflies are free to fly," it actually comes from Dickens' Bleak House. The quote is, "I only ask to be free, the butterflies are free. Mankind will surely not deny Harold Skimpole what it concedes to the butterflies."
Mm. Yeah. "Will not deny Skimpole."
All right. So my clickbait headline for Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy is Captain Fantastic outshines the brown dirt. So it's just... there's no dirt on this, you know. I mean, it's a, you know, just a shiny album, although not as shiny as other Elton John records, you know.
I think that's what I like about it so much, is it feels more grounded in reality, and it's not as performative.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's much easier to process than Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. I mean, it's a great album, but it was it goes so many directions. And and so this was just easy to process for a concept album, you know, and I tend to think of concept albums as being like these big pieces. This album doesn't feel big. It just feels like a regular album that has a narrative that goes throughout it. But, I mean, it's a very accessible album, although not, you know, overtly poppy other than Someone Saved My Life Tonight.
Yeah, you know, one interesting thing I read was that this was the first album to debut at number one on the Billboard 200. Like, no album had done that up to this point. The album cover, created by Alan Aldridge, is so interesting. Inspired by Hieronymus Bosch's The Garden of Earthly Delights, Renaissance painter. Mm. I guess it was one of the most expensive album covers ever commissioned. I mean, the packaging is beautiful. The gatefold is beautiful. There's a huge booklet with tons of details and pictures of them and throughout that first part of their history together. Mm. And then, you know, Tower of Babel is a standout track that delves into rock and roll gospel with biblical imagery, but critiquing the exploitative nature of the music industry, and Got to Get a Meal Ticket, describing the desperation of signing a contract just to survive in the music business.
Yeah. I'm surprised how like funky that track was. Like,
yeah.
There's some real like funk moments on here I wasn't expecting.
I think they were free at this point to just let it all go, do whatever, you know?
Like butterflies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Elton John himself has said that this is his finest work.
Hmm.
And then We All Fall in Love Sometimes, which is kind of, it sounds like a romance, but it's about falling in love with the pursuit of one's passion and this love between Bernie and Elton. It's not romantic in any way, but it's that their passion, the passion they shared for music. So, and then Curtains closes it out so nice.
Hmm.
I love this album. I've learned to love it because of my wife introducing it to me and describing it the way she did. So I'm going to nominate this for the Album Nerds Hall of Fame. I mean, the album tells a story. It resets what Elton John and Bernie Taupin were going to do moving forward and looking back at what they had accomplished together. And it's just so beautifully laid out. The music is great. The lyrics are great. Elton sounds amazing. And the fact that my wife recognized something in this at a young age tells me a lot about the album and about her being awesome. So it's a yes for me.
Well, I agree with all those things. For me, I just haven't listened to this record enough to really have a strong opinion on it one way or the other, I don't think. But I do. I'm enjoying it so far. So I'm going to say maybe.
Maybe's a no, folks.
All right. Well, I think Elton John and Bernie Taupin are just one of the great songwriting duos, you know, and I think it makes sense that we would have at least one Elton John record in our Hall of Fame. And this might be my favorite one, you know, as I'm trying to think about it now. I think it's probably the best listen from front to back. So yeah, I'll say yes.
Well, two's not enough. We need you, audience.
I think this will be a pretty easy audience vote, but that's let them have their voice. Go to our website, albumnerds.com, to cast your ballot for Mr. John and Mr. Taupin. And of course, look us up on the socials, Instagram and Facebook, to cast your vote there as well.
All right, so we need your help, people. That was Elton John with Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy. Check it out.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
All right. Well, did you guys have an opportunity to stop going through your spouse's things and, you know, collection to find anything else that you're digging?
Yeah, I got a couple of things here in my little heart-shaped clutch.
Wow.
Start up in Norway, the group called Krokofant. It's a three-piece progressive jazz group. They have a new album out. It's called Six. Let's play the opening cut.
That's what I think the noise in Andy's brain sounds like.
Just a constant stream of that. Very funky, definitely more jazz than rock, but pretty enjoyable, I would say. It's six tracks. Maybe that's why it's called Six.
Uh-huh.
All right. And the other one for me is a dance record by an artist by the name of Ella Minus. The album is called Dia. It's her second studio album. She's from Colombia. This album is made up of songs that seem to collectively ask, where we go from here, long after we've been broken, but long before we intend to be broken forever. Let's play track 5, QQQQ.
QQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQQ.
And she says it over and over again.
Oh.
That's great.
That's cool.
It's like Star Wars, right?
Yeah. What you been digging on, Don?
Well, I was reading the New York Times, believe it or not. And I read that this band, I think it's pronounced Simonde. They're a British funk group founded back in the 1970s. A lot of their songs ended up in a lot of early hip hop as samples. Two of the original members, anyway, are back, and they recorded an album called Renaissance. Here's a song called Chasing an Empty Dream. I actually kind of went back and I was listening to some of their earlier stuff. Pretty good.
I've never really considered British funk at all.
I know. Yeah. It sounds like just wouldn't work, but that does sound pretty cool.
Yeah, because I feel like funk requires some bad manners. And
well, this has, they actually have like a kind of a island sort of flavor.
Okay, yeah.
Nice.
Another one I've been listening to, Lucy Dacus. She has an album coming out, Forever is a Feeling. Comes out on March 28th. This is her fourth solo album. Here's a track called Ankles. Take me like you do in your dreams. She, of course, is in Boy Genius, who I think that was my record of the year a couple years ago.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think she's my favorite member of that group. I kind of like her vibe.
Yeah. I like the song Elbows better than Ankles, though.
I like cankles.
More of a risk guy, but
what are you digging, dude?
All right, it has become painfully obvious to me I've been spending too much time with Don and his kind of music, because I've been all about the UK lately. Fontaine's DC, the Lambrini Girls, Ditz from a couple weeks ago, and now Wonder Horse, a English rock band formed in 2020. Kind of grungy, a little more, dare I say, heartland rock, bluesy than some of the others. The 2024 album is Midas. Why don't we check out the title track?
Now, I don't know about you guys, but there are moments here where I hear a little Warren Zevon, a little...
That's like a kind of Springsteen.
Springsteen. This one has some of those touches where it sounds a little bit more of that raw rock sound. So it's nice. I've been enjoying it. So the next one up is Kal Akuma. The album is In the Mouth of Madness from 2021. It's a debut album from this Bangladeshi death metal band. And it's unrelenting, suffocating sounding, but it also has some doomy elements to it. Let's check out a little bit of the title track, In the Mouth of Madness.
Sounds like Sabbath.
Yeah.
It's kind of Sabbath meets Night Ranger.
I'm on a keyboard, maybe.
There we go. Yeah. I picked this album up because I was on a record website buying some stuff I wanted, Beach Boys and some other things, and I needed to get my cart up to a certain amount for free shipping. This was like $6. I'd never heard it. Album cover looked interesting. I didn't have anything like it in my collection, so even though I could have cheated and listened on Spotify, I didn't until I got it, and I enjoy it. I don't spend it a lot, but still a fun find and something that's cool to have in my collection.
I think that's awesome.
All right, well, what are you digging? Let us know. Join us on the socials, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Also on our website, albumnerds.com.
It will be a discovery of extraordinary value.
Well, it's about that time on the show, and I'm reminded of Hungarian-American actress Eva Gabor.
Ah,
this is kind of a deep cut here, guys. She was in Green Acres. Mm-hmm.
Of course. And she said darling a lot, right?
Darling, yes. I believe her sister was Zsa Zsa Gabor?
Yep.
Or maybe a family member? Well, Eva had a very interesting quote on love that I thought I would share. She said, "Love is a game that two can play and both win." It's very true. I feel like we're all winners on today's episode.
True.
With that in mind, let's bring out my friend and yours, Wadbot, and see what we'll be talking about on next week's episode.
Some albums have the power to brighten even the coldest and darkest days. Next time, you will be exploring records that lift spirits, shake off the winter blues, and remind us how music can be the perfect antidote to sadness.
Well, that's a heavy subject. Antidepressants. Finding albums that bring you out of the doldrums.
I thought we were doing methamphetamines.
I certainly hope not.
Yeah, that probably put you deeper in the depression.
Yes. What do you listen to break the winter doldrums? What else are you listening to? Email us at podcast@albumnerds.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, and Blue Sky at Album Nerds. Visit albumnerds.com to suggest topics for the show, peruse the Hall of Fame, and listen to all 279 episodes. And the best way to support the show is to share it. Please subscribe, rate, and review on your favorite podcast app.
Thank you once again for joining us on the Album Nerds podcast. We'll catch you next time when we turn that frown upside down with music.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See you then.
You're motoring. What's your price for flight?
That is my price for flight. I'm out of here.
Finally, we got the chorus.